Groups like this is creating a model for a more sustainable future, not only for forced migrants and minorities, but the entire human race.
Because our system of capitalism and white supremacy, what we definitely know is that we can't rely on governments to help, and the media propaganda machine is so well-financed and consistent that we are lacking not just political will but also human will. And I think this isn't really a time this year with COVID and 2020, this has also been a time for people to start waking up to their own power.
The International Rescue Committee says depression, post-traumatic stress disorder and self-harm that are the byproducts of hopelessness and despair have spiked amid COVID-19 restrictions. With the majority of asylum applications on pause, there's no means of escape, and during COVID-19, self-isolating often means being locked in a shipping container with many others.
More than half of those surveyed said that COVID has caused them depression, worry, anxiety and loneliness.
Every year, tens of thousands of refugees reach Greek shores. The media has aided the dehumanization of asylum seekers by reducing them to just that, a statistic. But there are still those fighting for stories to be told and lives celebrated. Bianca Rahimi, London.
On Friday, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, came down hard on the United States and its allies over their years-long sanctions against the Iranian people. Ayatollah Khamenei stressed that the measures are based on a baseless animosity and have to be lifted right away. Iran's leader noted that setting conditions for the removal of sanctions is nonsense. He said a possible U.S. return to the 2015 nuclear deal would be meaningless if the sanctions stay in place. Ayatollah Khamenei threw his weight behind a recent move by the Iranian government to scale down its commitments under the deal known as the JCPOA, saying that Tehran will not accept any obligations without reciprocal measures, adding that it would be meaningless for the Islamic Republic to implement all its commitments under the JCPOA when the other side implements almost none of its. Ayatollah Khamenei slammed comments made by some Western countries over Iran's regional policies. He stressed that Tehran will continue to play its role for regional stability, like its recent contribution to Iraq and Syria that led to the defeat of the Daesh terrorist group there. The Iran leader said that it is the U.S. that finds its interest in destabilizing the region, noting that such plots have been explicitly stated by some American thinkers, including someone from the American Enterprise Institute. Speaking on Iran's defense capabilities, Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the country is strong enough now to deter a war similar to the one launched by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein with arms and backing of the West in the 1980s. Iran's leader then touched upon recent developments surrounding the U.S. presidential election, saying the so-called American values and democracy have turned into a laughingstock even among American friends. He said what happened in Washington, D.C. was the very thing Americans were planning to incite in Iran over a decade ago.
Outgoing U.S. President Donald Trump has finally declared there will be an orderly transition of power. The news comes after violence in the nation's capital as Trump supporters stormed the Capitol building while lawmakers met to certify President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris. World leaders joined the chorus of outrage condemning the outgoing president for stoking the unrest. For weeks he undermined the result, claiming election fraud, and then rallied protesters to head to the Capitol. As angry demonstrators stormed Congress, one woman was shot dead by police and three others died of, quote, medical emergencies. An improvised explosive device was also intercepted by authorities. As the situation deteriorated, fellow Republicans urged Trump to call his protest off. Hours later, he posted a video reiterating his claims of fraud. He also cheered his supporters, saying he loved them and described them as special. but called on them to remain calm and return home. In an unprecedented step, Twitter took down the video and suspended his account, threatening permanent suspension if he continued to violate the social media platform. President of the European Council, Charles Michel, took to Twitter to voice his concerns. He joined world leaders calling for a peaceful transfer of power. Earlier, UK Home Secretary Priti Patel was asked about Trump's role in stoking anger and mistrust in the electoral process.
We've just seen, you know, confidence in democracy being shattered, quite frankly, and there's no justification for the level of violence, full stop, that was on show and has been on display. And people have been assaulted, people have died. The violence, you know, should stop, and he should absolutely condemn everything that has taken place.
In the early hours, Republican Senator Mitt Romney blamed President Trump for inciting a violent insurrection. He also downplayed suggestions of a congressional audit to placate angry Trump supporters.
For any who remain insistent on an audit in order to satisfy the many people who believe that the election was stolen, I'd offer this perspective. No congressional audit is ever going to convince these voters, particularly when the president will continue to say that the election was stolen.
Many predicted unrest, but Wednesday's scenes went beyond expectation. Four people dead, with lawmakers having to cower and abandon the historic building. In less than 2 weeks, President-elect Joe Biden will be inaugurated in the very same building, but with scenes of unrest, authorities will be bracing for more potential chaos, as the world watches the most powerful nation descend into even greater levels of division.
Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a name that defined Iran's nuclear energy program. The top Iranian nuclear scientist was assassinated in November last year. In terms of who was behind the incident, Iran has from the outset pointed the finger at Israel. Israel has a track record of killing Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. Fakhrizadeh is the fifth to be targeted. While Iran has revealed that it has tracked down some of those involved in the attack, families of the slain nuclear scientists have separately initiated a lawsuit at Iran's Court for International Affairs, not against Israel, but against the United States for, quote, systemic support for Israel's terrorist activities against Iran. The lead lawyer of the lawsuit says if the case is certified, Iran can freeze American assets in some countries and transfer them as compensation to the families of the victims.
The families of the slain scientists demand that the masterminds of the attacks be punished. Iran does not recognize Israel as a country, so we filed a lawsuit against the U.S. as the major supporter of Israel's crimes. The case will be reviewed at Iran's Court for International Affairs, and then we will take further legal proceedings at an international scale. This is to relieve part of the pain inflicted on the families of the victims.
Iran says the assassination of its scientists pursues a single goal: to deal a heavy blow to the country's nuclear program. But the emotional side effects are even heavier to bear for the families of the victims. Like 14-year-old Armita, who lost her father when she was only four. She says she will never forgive those who took away her dream. Israel has not commented on any of the assassinations of the Iranian scientists. But as to the last one, it has already spilled the beans on itself. Fakhrizadeh had long been on Israel's hit list. This remark by the Israeli Prime Minister perhaps says it all.
This is how Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Ahmad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
But this time around, Iran was quick to respond. Days ago, the country resumed enriching uranium to 20% purity, surpassing the 3.67% cap set by the 2015 nuclear deal.
While Tehran interprets the elimination of its nuclear scientists as nothing but an attempt to derail its nuclear program, the hunt for those culpable in Fakhrizadeh assassination is placing the remaining pieces of the puzzle, which observers say is giving stronger clues of an Israeli link to the issue. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
An official ceremony was held at the Assad House for Art and Culture in Damascus, marking the first martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's ambassador to Syria delivered a word condemning the assassination crime and asserting that the Iranian people have taken revenge and continue to do so. He also reiterated his country's ongoing support to the Syrian people and army until the full defeat of terror.
And The criminal act perpetrated by the U.S. administration is against all international laws and the U.N. Charter. It is an act rejected by the entire world. The assassination proves the failure of the aggressive plot aimed at supporting terrorism and spreading instability in this region.
The event was attended by a wide range of high-ranking officials. Dr. Buthaina Shaban, who was representing Syria's President Bashar al-Assad in the ceremony, said the U.S. assassinated General Soleimani out of fear of his successful strategy that undermined their plots in the region, stressing Syrians will learn many lessons from the general's life. On the sideline of the ceremony, an exhibition was held shedding light on General Soleimani's life and focusing on his achievements in the fight against terror in Syria and Iraq in the past decade. A year after Lieutenant General Soleimani's assassination, Syrians are clearly keen to demonstrate their respect to his sacrifices for their country. Ceremonies held across the country express the high level of appreciation everyone here has for what the general had offered for the security of Syrian territories. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Following the landslide victory of Venezuela's ruling Socialist Party in last December's legislative election, former Information Minister Jorge Rodriguez has now been appointed as the new Speaker of the Nation's Congress, also known as National Assembly. Rodriguez, who is widely regarded as one of President Nicolas Maduro's closest allies, has claimed that the newly elected Congress will work exhaustively to promote the policies of the country's president. The assumption of Rodriguez as head of parliament puts an end to a five-year-long control of the congressional body by the opposition, through which the spat between the executive and the legislative produced political turmoil in the Latin American Republic. Socialist lawmakers praised the designation of Rodriguez, although in the opposition some complain about the new head of parliament. Nonetheless, experts believe that the new parliament is a politically balanced body now. Now that Venezuela's ruling Socialist Party has regained control of the country's Congress, many believe that President Maduro is more stable than ever in his office. While the opposition has hit bottom in political terms, Jesus Silva of Caracas.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
House Democrats introduced an article of impeachment against President Donald Trump on Monday, 11th of January, for his role in inflaming a mob that attacked the Capitol, scheduling a Wednesday, 13th of January, vote to charge the president with inciting violence against the government of the United States if Vice President Mike Pence refused to strip him of power first. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Nicholas Fandos, with contributions from reporters Katie Edmondson, Luke Broadwater, Emily Cochran, and Zolan Cano-Youngs. The piece is titled, House Sets Impeachment Vote to Charge Trump with Incitement. Stay with us for more. House Democrats introduced an article of impeachment against President Donald Trump on Monday, 11th of January, for his role in inflaming a mob that attacked the Capitol, scheduling a Wednesday, 13th of January vote to charge the president with inciting violence against the government of the United States if Vice President Mike Pence refused to strip him of power first. Moving with exceptional speed, top House leaders began summoning lawmakers still stunned by the attack back in Washington. Promising the protection of National Guard troops and federal air marshal escorts after last week's stunning security failures. They returned set up a high-stakes 24-hour standoff between the two branches of the American government. As the impeachment drive proceeded, federal law enforcement authorities accelerated efforts to fortify the Capitol building ahead of President-elect Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s inauguration on 20th of January. The authorities announced plans to deploy up to 15,000 National Guard troops and set up a multi-layered buffer zone with checkpoints around the building by Wednesday, just as lawmakers are to debate and vote on impeaching Donald Trump. Federal authorities also said they were bracing for a wave of armed protests in all 50 state capitals and Washington in the days leading up to the inauguration. "I'm not afraid of taking the oath outside," Joe Biden said on Monday, referring to a swearing-in scheduled to take place on a platform on the west side of the Capitol, in the very spot where rioters marauded last week, beating police officers and vandalizing the building. Joe Biden signaled more clearly than before that he would not stand in the way of the impeachment proceeding, telling reporters in Newark, Delaware, that his primary focus was trying to minimize the effect an all-consuming trial in the Senate might have on his first days in office. He said he had consulted with lawmakers about the possibility they could bifurcate the proceedings in the Senate, such that half of each day would be spent on the trial and half on confirmation of his cabinet and other nominees. In the House of Representatives, a vote was scheduled for Tuesday evening to first formally call on Mike Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment. Republicans had objected on Monday to unanimously passing the resolution, which asked the Vice President Mike Pence to declare President Donald J. Trump incapable of executing the duties of his office and to immediately exercise powers as acting president. The House is slated to begin debate on the impeachment resolution on Wednesday morning, 13th of January, marching towards a vote late in the day unless Mike Pence intervenes beforehand. "The president's threat to America is urgent, and so too will be our action," Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California said, outlining a timetable that will most likely leave Donald Trump impeached 1 week to the day after he encouraged his supporters to march to the Capitol building as lawmakers met to formalize Joe Biden's victory. Donald Trump met with Vice President Mike Pence on Monday for about an hour in the Oval Office, the first time since their falling out last week over the president's effort to overturn the election and a mob assault on the Capitol building that also put Mike Pence in danger. A Trump administration official who declined to be identified speaking about the delicate situation said the two had a good conversation but would not say whether the issue of the 25th Amendment had been discussed. The vice president had already indicated that he was unlikely to act to force the president aside, and no one in either party expected Donald Trump to step down voluntarily. With that in mind, Democrats had already begun preparing a lengthier impeachment report documenting the president's actions and the destruction that followed to accompany their charge. They were confident they had the votes to make Donald Trump the first president ever to be impeached twice. The impeachment article invoked the 14th Amendment, the post-Civil War era addition to the Constitution that prohibits anyone who engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States from holding future office. Lawmakers also cited specific language from Donald Trump's speech last Wednesday, riling up the crowd, quoting him saying, "If you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore." The Republican Party was fracturing over the coming debate, as some agreed with Democrats that Donald Trump should be removed, and many others were standing behind the president and his legions of loyal voters. They were also fighting among themselves, with many Republicans furious over what took place a week ago, and blaming their own colleagues and leaders for having contributed to the combustible atmosphere that allowed a pro-Trump rally to morph into a deadly siege of the Capitol building. Unlike Donald Trump's first impeachment in 2019, few Republicans were willing to muster a defense of Trump's actions, and Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the top House Republican, privately told his conference that the president deserved some blame for the violence, according to two people familiar with his remarks. Representative Kevin McCarthy remained personally opposed to impeachment and tried to hold his conference together during a lengthy call on Monday afternoon. But as many as a dozen Republicans were said to be considering joining Democrats to impeach, including Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, the number three House Republican. "It's something we're strongly considering at this point," said Representative Peter Meyer, a freshman Republican from Michigan, told a Fox affiliate in his home state. "I think what we saw last Wednesday left the president unfit for office." Donald Trump gave his party little direction or reason to rally around him. Ensconced at the White House and barred from Twitter, he offered no defense of himself or the armed assailants who overtook the Capitol building, endangering the lives of congressional leaders, their staffers, and his own vice president. Meanwhile, Chad Wolf, the acting Secretary of Homeland Security, became the latest cabinet official to resign in the aftermath of the Capitol riot, stepping down just 9 days before he was expected to help coordinate the security at the inauguration on 20th of January. If Donald Trump is impeached by the House of Representatives, which now seems virtually certain, he would then face trial in the Senate, which requires all senators be in the chamber whilst the charges are being considered. Democrats had briefly considered trying to delay an impeachment trial until the spring to buy Joe Biden more time without the cloud of such a proceeding hanging over the start of his presidency. But by late Monday, most felt they could not justify such a swift impeachment and then justify a delay. Still, the timing of the trial remained unclear because the Senate was not currently in session. Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the top Democrat in the Senate, was considering trying to use emergency procedures to force the chamber back before 20th of January, a senior Democratic aide said, but doing so would take the consent of his Republican counterpart, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. House leaders said the timing and outcome of any Senate trial was secondary to their sense of urgency to charge President Donald Trump with crimes against the country. Whether impeachment can pass the United States Senate is not the issue, Representative Steny Hoyer of Maryland, the majority leader in the House, told reporters. "The issue is, we have a president who most of us believe participated in encouraging an insurrection and attack on this building and on democracy, and trying to subvert the counting of the presidential ballot." Representative Tom Reed, Republican of New York, said House Republicans will introduce a measure on Tuesday, 12th of January, to censure Donald Trump and ensure accountability occurs without delay for the events of Wednesday, 6th of January. Writing an opinion editorial article published Monday night by the New York Times, Tom Reed, a Republican representative, added, "We must also look at alternatives that could allow Congress to bar Donald Trump from holding federal office in the future." Other accountability efforts were underway in the shadow of the drive to punish Donald Trump. Law enforcement fanned out across the country to track down and arrest members of the mob and heavily fortified the Capitol, where National Guard troops clad in camouflage uniforms roamed the ornate corridors and patrolled the sidewalks outside. Representative Tim Ryan of Ohio said the Capitol Police were investigating roughly a dozen of their own officers and had suspended two for potentially aiding the insurrectionists. One took selfies with those laying waste to the Capitol. Another donned a Make America Great Again cap and potentially gave them directions, Mr. Ryan said. Any incidents of Capitol Police facilitating or being part of what happened, we need to know that, Tim Ryan of Ohio said. Progressive lawmakers called for investigations and possible expulsions of Republicans who had supported Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the election and help stoke the violence. More moderate Democrats discussed plans to try to ostracize them going forward, including by refusing to sign onto their legislative efforts or routine requests because they were likely to remain in Congress. Republicans stoking the bogus claims of election theft themselves were mostly unapologetic and insisted their actions had nothing to do with the violence done in Donald Trump's name. The four-page impeachment article charges Donald Trump with inciting violence against the government of the United States when he sowed false claims about election fraud and encouraged his supporters at a rally outside the White House to take extraordinary measures to stop the counting of electoral votes underway at the Capitol building. A short time later, rioters mobbed the building, ransacking the seat of American government and killing a Capitol Police officer. At least four others died as a result of injuries or medical emergencies on Capitol grounds. In all of this, President Trump gravely endangered the security of the United States and its institutions of government, the impeachment article read. He threatened the integrity of the democratic system, interfered with the peaceful transition of power, and imperiled a co-equal branch of the government. He thereby betrayed his trust as president to the manifest injury of the people of the United States. Modern presidential impeachments have been drawn-out affairs, allowing lawmakers to collect evidence, hone arguments, and hear the president's defense over the course of months. When the Democratic-led House impeached Donald Trump the first time, it took nearly 3 months, conducting dozens of witness interviews, compiling hundreds of pages of documents, and producing a detailed case in a written report which ran to 300 pages. It appeared this time round that the House planned to do so in less than a week, with little more evidence than the fast-accumulating public record of cell phone videos, photographs, police and journalistic accounts, and the words of Donald Trump himself. To those who would say, "Why do it now? There are only 9 days left in the president's term," said Joe Neguse of Colorado, who has been drafting messaging guidance for the party. "I would say there are 9 days in the president's term." Donald Trump's most outspoken defenders opposed impeachment, though most did not explicitly defend his conduct. Many of them, who just last week backed his drive to overturn Joe Biden's victory and voted to toss out legitimate results from key battleground states, argued that to impeach the president now would only further divide the country. Some moderate Democrats were growing uneasy about the implications of such fast and punitive action, fearful both of the consequences for Joe Biden's agenda during his first days in office and of further igniting violence across the country among Donald Trump's most extreme supporters. They tried to cobble together support for a bipartisan censure resolution instead, but it appeared it might be too late to stop the momentum in favor of impeachment. House Leader Nancy Pelosi shut down the idea during her private call with Democrats, saying that censure would be an abdication of our responsibilities, according to an official familiar with her remarks.
The debate.
Going against warnings from fellow lawmakers and advisors, the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is to designate Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization. The warning, this would exacerbate the humanitarian situation in the country, suffering from all kinds of diseases like malnutrition and famine. Now, in this edition of the debate, we will ask, what is this world coming to when the ones that are being bombed are being sanctioned, while the ones doing the bombing and the killing can go scot-free and get a green pass to continue the siege and the killing.
Saudi Arabia and its allies, backed by the United States, launched a devastating war against Yemen in March 2015 to oust the Ansarullah movement, which took power following the resignation of the country's former president, Abdel Rabbuh Mansour Hadi. The conflict that has so far killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children, has been described by the United Nations as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Nonetheless, in defiance of calls to help end the war, the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has decided to blacklist the Ansarullah movement. His Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said the designation will take place on January 19th, the day before President-elect Joe Biden takes office. In a statement, Pompeo accused the movement of terrorist acts, destabilizing the region and obstructing a peaceful solution to the conflict in Yemen. The allegations drew backlash from Yemeni officials.
Taking this decision at this time is the result of great local and international political pressure to stop the war in Yemen. And America is the one that does not want to stop this war and this aggression.
Yemen's Supreme Political Council also branded the United States as a source of terrorism and vowed to respond to its designation move. Iran also condemned the U.S. for branding Ansarullah a terrorist entity.
It's likely the bankrupt U.S. government will do further damage to its reputation in its final days and leave the region with an even more poisonous legacy.
Aid groups also blasted the U.S. blacklisting move, with Oxfam calling the decision a counterproductive and dangerous policy that will put innocent lives at risk. The United States, along with some other Western countries, are major suppliers of weapons to Saudi Arabia. The Trump administration has so far turned a deaf ear to calls from international rights groups and politicians inside the U.S. to halt arms sales to the kingdom. Now the ball is in the court of Joe Biden, who will officially take the helm at the White House on January 20th. It remains to be seen whether he will toe the line of his predecessor towards Yemen or change course.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, radio host and political commentator Eli Joseph James, joins us from Chicago. We also have journalist and political analyst Elijah McNair, who joins us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome. Let me first start with you, Elijah McNair, if I may. We're looking at this sanction that the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has announced against the Ansarullah movement. And it does consist of three of its leading leaders. Now, Mike Pompeo, months ago, was advised against not doing this, or the Trump administration, but yet it has chosen this time to do it. Why do you think that is? Why do you think this day was the day that it, or this time is the time that the announcement was made?
Well, the architect of the Saudi war on Yemen is definitely Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who has failed to develop a comprehensive strategy because he has no military experience or training. He lacks government management and a necessary intelligence to acknowledge that this is a useless war and far from being considered as a victory. He rather engaged in multiple human rights violations and crimes against humanity and gave an incentive for the Houthis to develop their deterrence. Now, it is the U.S. State Department who is responsible for the designation of foreign terrorist organizations. So the Crown Prince pushed Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in his last 8 days, and Pompeo, who visited Riyadh in the last few months, he pushed him to issue a designation against the Houthis, who never attacked Americans, but fought against Al-Qaeda and against the invaders of their countries. And here we're talking about Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. A foreign terrorist organization designation is definitely a political act. So the Trump administration could have made the technical decision to designate the Houthis any time in the last 4 years during the Trump administration. Now, under Biden administration, removing the designation is not that easy. It's a difficult political and bureaucratic process. Now, branding the Houthis as terrorists would be an attempt to block Biden and the world from speaking to the Houthis. The reality is the Houthis control most of northern Yemen, and it's better to hold direct talk with them than to live in a denial and ignore their control and presence in Yemen. Now, having direct contact with the Houthis will establish dialogue, direct talk, exchange of prisoners, halt the attacks on both sides, bring to Sana'a humanitarian support. The Saudis are desperate because the new Biden administration said it will block arms delivery to the kingdom and hold Crown Prince accountable for the Yemen war and all the murders that he did, and in particularly the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi 2 years ago in Istanbul. Even if the new administration doesn't hold Mohammed bin Salman to account, it is likely that there will be a cooperation in the Congress. So designing the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization, it is definitely going to make it extremely difficult, that already difficult situation on the ground. It will neutralize the effort of humanitarian release organization to get food and medicine to millions of Yemenis.
Let's continue that trend of thought, Eli Joseph James. And ask you, given the fact that the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was advised from months ago, and as our guest there from years ago, perhaps, if they wanted to designate the group as a terrorist organization, they may have been told this, that they're going to have a situation humanitarian-wise that's going to get exacerbated. After all, this is the world's largest humanitarian crisis. But given that fact and knowledge that the Secretary of State did have, he still went ahead. Or the Trump administration still went ahead with this. Do you think that? Why do you think that is? Why would they do this?
Well, let me say first that President Trump has actually been a relative peacemaker while he's been president. The Democratic Party, with Obama, escalated the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, etc. It's Trump who's pulled out troops and has not made any new wars, which has been unusual for American presidents to not engage us in any new wars. However, given the fact that Biden and Hillary Clinton are cut from the same cloth, I would not expect any promises by Biden to be kept on behalf of Yemen and Houthi, none whatsoever. That's just propaganda he's issuing because he wants to curry favor with anybody who doesn't like Donald Trump, okay? Remember, it was Hillary Clinton who orchestrated the assassination of Gaddafi in Libya, and Biden has always been a supporter of Hillary Clinton, so I would not expect 1 ounce of support from Biden except rhetoric. That's all I would expect from Biden. As to why Mike Pompeo has done this, again, I think it's just posturing by people. I don't think Trump wants to get us involved in yet another conflict, and from my perspective, America has pretty much stayed out of this, except for rattling sabers on behalf of Saudi Arabia and the Israelis. But this, from my perspective, this is Saudi Arabia's war against Yemen, so the Saudis need to be held accountable for invading a sovereign country. I don't know why they did it, but probably at the behest of the Israelis, whose basic policies in the Middle East is to disrupt every other nation except Israel. That's their basic policy. And because the Zionists have so much power here in America, whatever administration we have is pretty much going to do their will.
Okay.
The conclusion,
Elijah Magnier, that I'm getting from our guest there, Elijah Joseph James, is that the U.S. under President Donald Trump did not engage in a war during his 4 years, and Israel is the one that is interfering or that is somewhat having a hand in all the countries in West Asia, as we call it, or the Middle East. My question would be then, does the U.S. subscribe to provide military equipment via arms sales to countries like Saudi Arabia? Does that make it exempt from not participating in a war, like in this case, Yemen, in which, by some accounts, hundreds of thousands have died?
I tend to agree with the half of the answer. So, yes, Israel acted as an advisor to Trump in giving it the Syrian Golan Heights, the occupied Syrian Golan Heights, Jerusalem, and Pompeo gave the settlement to Israel. But I fully disagree with your guest when saying Trump did not start a war. Indeed, he has started many wars, because war is not only military, it's also about sanctions. And he starved people in Venezuela, he starved people in Iran, in Syria, in Lebanon. So that is another soft war that is more harmful than a military war. And we saw the war on Iraq, how the Americans defeated Saddam Hussein, but then they couldn't win the war. So they found another way to allow ISIS to occupy the country. So no, Trump also killed General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Mohandes. So yes, he made assassinations, and he pushed the whole Middle East to the verge of a very general war that he could start it but not end. On the other hand, in relation to Yemen, the U.S. sold weapons to Saudi Arabia to continue the war on Yemen, and that is a very direct participation to the war crime that the Saudis are committing with U.S. weapons and German and French and the U.K. So there are many participants to this war in Yemen, not directly with many troops on the ground, but there are definitely some U.S. troops guiding the Saudis and offering intelligence, and that is a war that have participated. So it is not right to say the U.S. is not participating to the war on Yemen. It is directly participating to the war, and Trump is responsible for the starvation. That's a soft war on many other countries in the Middle East.
Well, Joseph James, I mean, we can't just skim over. I mean, when I asked you the question, you immediately went and talked about how under Obama, so forth and so on, and Biden is a supporter of Clinton. My question to you was about the humanitarian aspect. We can't skip over this. We're looking at the world's worst humanitarian crisis. This move puts humanitarian access at risk. There are people who are not only dying from now COVID-19, they're dying of starvation, famine, all different sorts of diseases. At the same time, what our guest there from Brussels said, it risks future peace talks between the Ansarullah and the opposition. Does the U.S. then want to sabotage, perhaps, any chance of peace by making this type of announcement?
Well, first let me say I can't argue with anything that Elijah just said in terms of boycotts, because yes, indeed, boycotts are a form of war, right? I was just referring to a military invasion. But yes, the United States government has been in bed with the Israelis since the Six-Day War. And in fact, the Israelis attacked one of our ships, the USS Liberty, and that's been downplayed and even totally suppressed. You know, so the Israelis make war on everybody. They make war on everybody. But it's the Rothschild banks that run the show in virtually every country in the world, except possibly Iran. I'm not sure if there's any other country that has been resisting the will of the Israeli state and the Zionists who control the world economy. They control the world economy. So if any American president or leader contradicts the will of these Zionists, he's the first one going to be assassinated, as President Kennedy found out. So you can't blame this on the Americans. You have to look at the source. And I think, in spite of all that, Trump has been a less aggressive president than anybody else. What I'm trying to say to you and Elijah is, expect Biden to be far worse than Trump.
So this leaves us now in a situation where, as you said, Elijah, the Biden administration, I mean, this thing is going to go into effect possibly the 19th of January, a day before President-elect Biden's inauguration. So it's going to leave, kind of pass on the baton to him. What type of approach may we expect from Biden? Will he be proactive, as the news now indicates, for example, today, where key U.S. lawmakers actually urged a quick reversal of this? And I'm going to quote, "The designation of the Ansarullah as a terrorist organization is a death sentence for thousands of Yemenis," coming from Senator Chris Murphy.
Unfortunately, we can no longer trust what the president or president-elect or president candidates are saying. We saw what Obama said before the elections, and we saw what Trump said before the elections, and now we hear what Biden is saying prior to the election. So there are many talks today within the U.S. administration and many talks of the presidential candidates that they change their mind once they are in power. And we see Biden may have priorities like China, like Russia, like the nuclear deal with Iran, and perhaps Yemen is not on top of his list, as well as the withdrawing from Iraq or from Syria, or leaving Lebanon alone to sort out its own problem. So basically, we can't really trust what Biden is going to do, and we don't have to give a lot of weight to what he said against the Saudis and that he's going to stop the war in Yemen. Definitely, we can come out with the conclusion that Pompeo is doing everything he can to put pressure and to slow down any process the new Biden administration may have things to do in the future to remove all these sanctions, because, I mean, the guy is not stopping. Every single day in the last 20 days, he's coming out with a new sanction. So what Biden is going to do is really unclear, and how much time he needs to undo all these obstacles that Pompeo is putting in front of him, or perhaps benefit from these already imposed sanctions and are in place to say, hey, I didn't do it, that's Trump, and I need time to undo everything. So personally speaking, I cannot trust the Biden administration and say this guy is going to come and make changes. He had the domestic first, he had the relationship with the allies that are spoiled, and then he has China, Russia, etc. So no, I don't think the war on Yemen, the criminal and devastating war on Yemen, is going to stop in one day or in one month even.
Well, let's try to figure out, Elijah Joseph James, what this war is all about. I mean, maybe you can tell us. Do you know what this war is all about?
Well, yes. I'm not sure. Oh, all I know is that the Saudis invaded Yemen, right? Not the other way around. And as you said at the very beginning, it's the victims who are being blamed for the crisis, when the crisis, when the big bully in the Middle East there is Saudi Arabia. They're the big bully. And as I have stated many times here at Press TV, the Saudis are puppets of the Israelis, and they do the will of the Israelis without question. So, and they're using the Saudis to destabilize the rest of the countries in the Middle East. That's what they're doing, especially Iran. We know what they did to Iraq, but they've pitted Iraq against Iran in the war and elevated Saddam Hussein. Then they stabbed him in the back and made war against him. So this is the only kind of activity you can expect. And unfortunately, our government is so weak vis-a-vis the Zionist power. And of course, from the UN, because the UN is just another paper tiger in terms of how they approach these issues. Yeah, okay, so they may condemn the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, but what are they going to do? They're not going to do anything because the Rothschilds created the UN, the Rothschilds created the Israeli state, and really what needs to happen is the other Middle East countries, when there used to be an oil cartel, what we called an oil cartel,